Hi, it's Joe Lowry. Welcome to another episode of the Global Lithium Podcast. This is episode 83, and my first time as the guest. I will reveal the identity of the host at the end of the podcast, unless you happen to recognize his voice. He has a larger presence than I do in the overall investing world, for sure, but is not focused specifically on lithium. So you may or may not be familiar with this gentleman. I like the idea of I'm on his show and felt that this would be a good podcast episode for the many people who have written me since I started this and suggested that I should be the guest at some point. So for better or for worse, you have your wish. Before we get started, some comments about recent happenings in the lithium world. There's been some buzz about the courts allowing the Nemaska sale to happen. Hope springs eternal in the lithium world. I would not hold my breath if you're expecting to see production, especially chemical production, from that asset in the next 3 or 4 years. The operation of just Whabouchi really doesn't make economic sense at this point, although I do believe in the further distant future, a spodumene asset alone in Quebec could be viable based on the boom in the battery build-out in the EU, especially if the politicians actually follow through with their stated commitments to support, read, subsidize Europe's battery supply chain. Even though it's been a few weeks, the fallout from Tesla Battery Day, especially relative to their lithium strategy, continues to be a story. I will just repeat that I do not believe that Tesla, 5 years from now, will be producing lithium chemicals from their own resource in Nevada or anywhere else. I do believe they could be producing lithium hydroxide as a converter in Texas. That's a little easier to do, although not terribly easy and not something that Tesla has any core competency in, but it could happen. But if they do that, I don't believe the raw material will come from North Carolina. I believe it will come from Western Australia. And with that, let's get to this episode.
Joe, how are you doing, sir?
Fine. Thanks for having me on.
A pleasure. People were quite excited that you're coming on, actually. You've got quite the fan base, desperately striving to catch up with your daughter, who's got a huge following. But she's an author, published author.
That's right. And that's probably not going to happen. I don't have enough runway left to catch her. So,
okay. Erin Lowry, writer of Broke Millennials. Right. Okay. I'm promoting her. You see what just happened? Pitch.
I do it all the time.
Good man. Good father. Hey, well, Jay, thanks for coming on. So you're the lithium guy, sometimes referred to as the lithium sheriff, I'm hearing. And you're going to tell us all about your journey into the world of lithium and what you're up to now. So thanks for joining us on our humble little show. We're trying to learn about the world of lithium. It seems very unloved at the moment, up until the last few weeks, it seems.
Lithium goes in and out of favor. It's pretty obvious. And I just keep plugging along. So I don't pay much attention to the haters. I just do what I do.
It's tough out there. I mean, if you've got an opinion, you're going to have people that like it and people that, you know, don't like it so much. And it's tough to kind of put yourself out there constantly, especially on something, you know, battery metals, lithium. It's difficult.
Well, if you go back to 2016 when lithium spiked, and I was probably talking to two hedge funds a week, and everybody, you know, just had to talk, and It's a complicated, tiny space. I mean, the market for lithium chemicals didn't reach $1 billion till 2015. Think about that. It's a global industry. You can't make the statin anti-cholesterols without lithium chemicals. You can't make post-it notes without lithium chemicals. And you can't make a lithium ion battery without lithium, no matter what Elon would tell you about what it ought to be called.
It's, I mean, what you say, that's kind of interesting. By the way, just for people watching this, we're going to kind of bounce around a bunch of topics because we're kind of getting to know each other. We've not spoken or met before. Your reputation precedes you, of course. So we're going to bounce around a few different topics here, but that's quite interesting. Straight off the bat, it's a small industry.
Tiny.
So why did you get into it?
You know, it's an interesting thing. I went to work for an oil company in Oklahoma City, then Houston after graduate school. And I, at that time, it was the 80s, I never planned on leaving because I loved it. But there were some breakup artists out there about the time, and I worked for one of the oil companies that was broken up. So as the headhunters are wont to do, they start circling and start saying, well, why don't you consider this or that? FMC Corporation had a bunch of different businesses, and I liked extractive industries for whatever reason. So I went to work for their gold mining outfit in Reno, Nevada. And that's where I started with FMC. And, you know, my job was to take their overvalued stock and buy some small assets with it. And I did that. And 18 months later, it was time to move on. So I put my hat in the ring for a job at their lithium business. And I'd done some research on lithium, and I found it to be interesting because it was involved. It was the genesis of the lithium industry was to get the trigger for the hydrogen bomb. That interested me. I wanted to stay in a small town. So I moved from Reno to Gastonia, North Carolina, which defines a small southern town. And being a Yankee, that was quite interesting too, especially being a Catholic Yankee in a small southern town was quite interesting. I was in finance then. I was running their finance department. And after 18 months, I said, I'm going to go brain dead here. So I talked to the new guy running the place and said, I'd really like a commercial job. And HR had said, the hell you say, you know, you're not a chemical engineer. And I said, well, I'm a relatively bright human being, and the chemical engineers aren't really very good at selling this stuff. They get all hooked on the chemistry, not on the economic value of what we're doing. That was my pitch. The guy bought it, and I just happened to hit the commercial world at the right time. You know, the lithium ion battery was just coming into the market. I made my first trip to Japan. Our product had been picked by Sony, and it went from there. I mean, I started going to Japan every 6 weeks. After 5 years of doing that, they said, why don't you just move over there? So I moved my family over to Japan in the beginning of 2000. Spent 5 years there. Then they said, why don't you move to China? And I said, okay. And so we moved to China. So my kids grew up and spent 11 years in Asia. And that is why I know all the lithium players, though. It's, you know, I got to meet the cathode makers. I actually ran a cathode joint venture myself. And then as China was emerging, the guys who started Ganfeng were billionaires now, were very good friends of mine. And I helped them get going by doing deals with them based on my role at FMC, now Livent at the time. And I know the guy who started Tianqi pretty well. So it was a good launching pad to get out of corporate life and do something else, because there aren't many people that know much about lithium.
Well, that's true, because it's a small space.
Still. Tiny.
There's not that many players. Obviously, you know, it occasionally, the spotlight is shone upon them occasionally, as you say, like 3 years ago. Market was good, then not so good, and Tesla, you know, making their noises with Piedmont, you know, a few weeks ago. Sure. But I want to kind of stick with the kind of history of, you know, getting to where you are, because I want to know the man. Okay, so, you know, we had a great chat before the cameras turned on, but so you bounced around Asia, which was obviously the driver, it seems, for, you know, battery metals at the moment. Sure. What are you doing today? I mean, is it kind of like advisory roles? Are you working with different companies at the moment? I mean, how do you make it today based on all that information?
I've done a lot of different things. I mean, for example, when in Toyota Tsusho, it was investing in Orocobre, my former JV partner in Japan was asked to get Toyota Tsusho a lithium expert.
And so I taught them the basics of the industry for 3 years until the thing started up. And I advised Gangfin for many years. Actually, Lithium Americas, I have a relationship with. They asked me to help them raise money for Kachari. I introduced them to Gangfin and was in the middle of raising $272 million for them. And I had originally turned them down because I said, I don't do that. That's not what I do. I'm not a fundraising guy. And you do what you do. And then CATL, who you've probably heard of, came to me in 2016 and asked me to help them put together a lithium strategy. So I advised them for a while. And, you know, I've advised cathode companies, governments. I was asked at one point by the government of Western Australia to help them with a royalty regime. And in the paperwork was to do that was so thick. I said, no thanks. Plus it'll piss everybody off if I, if I'm out helping to raise the taxes on lithium producers. So I declined that role, but I do a lot of that. And then I do a lot of one-off, you know, one, a very large industrial company that has a significant lithium demand, and I can't say who they are, wanted to stress test their lithium strategy. So they hired me, and That's the kind of stuff I do.
Okay. So I just want to be able to say, you know, why are you qualified to talk to us about lithium today? I think we can tick the box. Okay. So given all of that, what do you think the state of play is like for lithium today? How healthy is the market today?
We have never seen a time when it was more confused. You can make a case for any theory right now and have data to back it up. If you're Morgan Stanley and say this is a commodity and it's just supply demand, you just look at the China spot price and say, hey, and Orocobre backs you up because their last quarterly quoted price, or their realized price was like 39.13 or something. I think that's exactly right. And you can take my case, which is battery quality lithium is going to be in short supply very soon because the brine producers and the hard rock producers, and we should get into that, they haven't cracked the code on how to make all battery quality. And it never mattered for the first 15 years of the battery industry, when the battery demand was less than 50% of lithium output, didn't matter. You could lot select. The brine guys all had to lot select. But all the growth going forward is going to be battery. So we've got a world now where, by my numbers, last year was about 60% battery demand. It's probably going to 90 or 95 by 2025, just on e-mobility and energy storage system growth. And in that world, everybody has a tougher time, and you're going to have a whole new industry. You can call it the lithium cleaners, if you will, but there's a lot of lithium that's going to have to be upgraded, and that's going to use capacity too. So there's going to be a double whammy on capacity shortage very soon. I don't know, because in a COVID world, I would have told you before the end of 2021, if we'd had this conversation in January, it might be 2022 now. But when there's a shortage and it happens, then it'll be just like 2015, 2016. The spot price in China will become the highest price, not the lowest. You will gradually see the tier ones go from, I mean, right now in Korea and Japan, they're still paying around 10,000 plus or minus for battery quality lithium carbonate, a little more for hydroxide. And when the shortage comes, because they have contracts and relationships, those prices will migrate north, but more slowly. But the spot price, I sold a little under 1% of the market in 2016 myself, and my price was $28,650. And don't ask me how I just kept that price. I somebody paid it and I said, okay, that's good. I'm just going to keep it. Nobody believed it could happen in 2015. If you just talk to somebody in June and say, you know, next year at this time, you're going to be close to 30,000 a ton, they would have just carted you away. But that is in fact what happened, and it's going to happen again, and it's going to last a lot longer this time.
And the reason, why do you say that?
Well, the reason is because of things like what Elon Musk did at Battery Day. Make this case that lithium's easy. I'm just going to take a little thing, a salt shaker, a Morton's, and some clay, and presto changeo. That hurts investment in lithium projects. And we haven't seen the kind of investment you're going to need. Last time when there was a shortage, EV penetration was 1%.
Talk to me about that. I want to talk to you about Let me talk to you about Tesla Day. And I did want to talk about it later on, but we're talking about it now, so let's go for it. And, you know, the whole 2-minute segue of just add some salt, bit of water, lithium clay, problem solved, gangbang, that's how it's done. That's what we heard, right? And the reality, I suspect, will be something different, or perhaps it was a distraction. What's your opinion on that kind of role play thing that they did?
There was a lot of... there's a lot of good things about Battery Day. The lithium discussion was not one of them. And it turned into kind of a frat party at that. I expected to see some red cups and a lot more horn honking in the parking lot. It's like, you know, go Tesla. I think he did the industry and himself a disservice, because it just, in 2015, I used to give what I called the Lithium Awards, and I gave him the Mark Twain Award in 2015. He was number 5. He got the lift for saying lithium is salt on the salad. And I said, you know, you can say the battery should be called nickel cobalt, but now he's using LFP too. There's no nickel or cobalt in an LFP battery, but you can't make any of those batteries without lithium. And he can say it's easy. He can try to diminish the importance. Why does he do that? I don't understand why he does it. Because this was similar to when he tried to buy Symbol Materials, and I was an advisor to Symbol Materials, and he got very petulant after the VCs that were involved took his $325 million offer and said, nah, pay us $1.6 billion. And his offer was fair, in my opinion. That's an aside. But then within the next year, he does agreements with Pure Energy and Bacanora, and they still haven't delivered any commercial lithium. But it seemed then, and it seems now, he's trying to send a message to the lithium industry. And if I could speak for the lithium industry to Elon Musk, I would say, Elon, you need us more than we need you. Because Tesla's a story. It's a big story. It's an important story, but it isn't the only story. Because this whole transition isn't about just EVs. It's about e-mobility. And if you go to India, you're not going to have a bunch of Teslas. You're going to have a bunch of three-wheelers and two-wheelers, and they're going to be lithium in the future too.
That's kind of interesting to me, because I think, you know, obviously you've got people who are very pro-Elon and some who are against him. And, you know, that's the way it always is in the world of investing. But it struck me that, you know, when we were talking to companies prior to Battery Day, there were a lot of them who were, you know, advanced, whether they be brine or hard rock or clays, that were just struggling to get finance for simple things like pilot plants, trying to get finance, you know, trying to get off the back of their BFSs, trying to get finance for, you know, their CapEx. And because the market wasn't listening to them, because there's also this narrative going on, like you mentioned one of the banks earlier, who said, well, you know, the big boys will just turn the taps back on and then we've got all the supply we need because it's bountiful. And Elon said that. It's everywhere.
Yeah. No, that's what I'm saying.
That does damage the industry, but it damages our ability to get financed as well. So shouldn't he be working more hand in hand, given what you've just said, that he needs you more than you need them?
You know, knowing people inside Tesla, knowing people inside the lithium companies that Tesla's talking to, Tesla's pretty much talked to everybody. And Tesla wants unreasonable deals in many cases. Live the dream.
What's that mean? Unreasonable? Because he's done the same thing.
Let me go back to 2014. I picked J.B. Straubel up and some of the other guys. And I can't remember if Kurt Kelde came in with him or not. But anyway, we had, you know, the top guys except for Elon in a little shack near the Salton Sea when he had made he was looking at it. It was a pre-offer, but he was looking at Symbol. And they came in and said, like, we need $3,500 a ton lithium hydroxide. Now, nobody's cash cost was anywhere near that at the time, and it still isn't. But it was just, well, you have to do first principles. You know, you guys are mired in the old minings. You need to be like us, yada, yada, yada. And I don't feel like, for example, J.B. Straubel, I don't think he wasn't arrogant about it at all. And he wasn't the one saying it either. But it was this whole kind of puff out our chest, you know, you need to get where we are, you know, we're changing the world. And the real irony of that discussion in those days was that Symbol was trying to do something that had never been done. They were actually trying to do new technology, lithium from geothermal. The guy who had brought me into it had actually has a patents on Livent's extraction technology in Argentina. It just, that was my first kind of go round that, and I was back in Fremont in 2015 and with another company that was trying to supply. And it was the same kind of discussion. Oh, you got to go to first principles. It hasn't been enough innovation, blah, blah, blah. Making chemicals isn't software. there's a lot more to it than a smart 15-year-old doing an app and making $1 billion. You got to get permits. You've got energy requirements. Oftentimes your assets are in inhospitable places. It just isn't that easy. And it,
so I, you I just add salt. Just yeah. Add salt. That's what happens.
Well, and the irony of that is that's been tried. He said he didn't, to his knowledge, nobody had done it. People have done that process in China, not with clay, with lepidolite. And it can be done. It's just like you can get lithium. You can get lithium from the ocean too. Pacific Lithium proved that 25 years ago. It just costs so much. It's not going to lower your dollars per kilowatt hours.
Okay, but sorry, I'll be more serious.
No need to be serious.
Back to first principles, it's great saying that, and obviously the difficulty of doing that because chemicals aren't easy. I buy that, but should they be working with mining? Because we've had a discussion around nickel, okay, and we've had a discussion around copper, and it's the same conversation effectively, where they have changed and revolutionized in the manufacturing process in a way. They've sped things up, lowered costs. They continue to drive costs down, but they can't keep demanding something that's impossible unless they help the industry. At the moment, it seems to be taunting. Is that what you're feeling?
It was interesting because I actually went back to Tesla after that Symbol deal fell through when I was still advising Symbol, which no longer exists. And it's been bankrupt and bought for nothing by somebody else. But I went back and said, look, all we need to get financed is a kind word from Tesla, maybe a little contract. And, I was told, I was in the car on the phone, and the guy says, well, we just don't do that. And then I think it was a week later, they announced the Pure Energy deal, which was a joke. Anybody involved knew that in the industry. I mean, that's the other problem. I mean, there's not that many people around the world who really understand what it takes to bring lithium to market.
Tell me about that, because again, it's something we see a lot where deals happen, the market goes nuts. It doesn't, not just lithium, I'm talking about other commodities. Sure. And the insiders in that vertical are going, that'll never work. Not out of jealousy, but because we know that won't work. I mean, so tell us about that deal. Why were you guys going?
Well, first of all, you've asked other guests about direct lithium extraction, and that it would have required a real working direct lithium extraction process. And at the time, price was so low that even if they had DLE, it wouldn't have been economic. I mean, this is another story that the battery guys have to get used to, is that if you're going to take the market to 3 terawatt hours just for Tesla in 2030, then you're going to have to bring on all sorts of marginal assets where the cost curve is only going north. And you can say, well, if we go to first principles and get a lot of salt, we can probably crack the nut. But I promise you, the table salt solution is not going to be what changes the game.
Right. Okay. So this is a show for retail investors. So I want to kind of keep it simple initially. Let's get the macro. I doubt it. Looking at the macro thesis, you're going, right, battery grade lithium is required. We don't have enough of it. We're going to have to find new ways of producing it to fulfill the demand that's coming down the line. Okay, so we're all on the same page there. So where do you look first? Because if I'm an investor, I'm hearing stories, there are people who are pro lithium, pro hard rock, pro clays. Brines, Hard Rock, and Clays. Everyone's got their own favorite. I mean, where do you sit? Or do you think it's all of the above?
I love all my children. I don't have a favorite.
Really?
Both of them. I've said this many times and been criticized by even some people that have been on this show, that the world will maintain a relative balance between brine, hard rock, and then later on sedimentary, which is what I call clay, because a volcanologist named Tom Benson told me I should be doing that. It was more proper. And he's got degrees from Stanford, MIT, and some other highfalutin school. So I follow orders. So shout out to you, Tom. You're gonna see in the future, because let's just look at the cost curve for a sec. And this is the genesis of that whole argument. The lowest cost hydroxide right now is produced from raw material that comes from the Greenbushes mine, which is the creme de la creme of hard rock in Western Australia. Albemarle and Tianqi own it. De facto, with they transfer, you know, the way they operate that JV, they transfer it to themselves on a pro rata basis and a little bit of oversimplification, but their cash cost is the lowest cash cost for lithium hydroxide. Ergo, the Western Australians like to say, well, hard rock is lower cost. Well, it's the lowest cost, but if I was going to sidle somebody up next door on the cost curve, it wouldn't be the next hard rock guy. It would be my former employer, Livent, who produces lithium carbonate, then lithium hydroxide. But if you look at where they sit on the carbonate cost curve and what the conversion cost is, the cost curve is mixed by project. So you can't make the sweeping assumption that just because the lowest hard rock guy is the lowest cost guy, that the next lowest cost hard rock guy, and the whole narrative on ESG and that it's more sustainable, that's nonsense too. Let's just put it out there. Because if you start doing the carbon footprint on mining in WA and loading it up in a boat and taking it to the coast of China and moving it inland and converting it and then shipping it out and do a real honest carbon footprint, I'd like to see the, you know, life cycle analysis studies of that. Because you can pretty much get what's called qualified people to sign off on anything. The next thing I know, that donuts will be the best route to low-cost lithium chemicals. I mean, I've seen PFS and DFS. None of them qualify for the nonfiction list on the New York Times. I mean, if you, and this is what we were talking about before we started, that's what I learned when I got into the kind of the junior world, is there's a lot of smarmy juniors out there, and you can get everybody that hasn't produced commercially is on the low end of the cost curve. It's only after they come into production that
it's interesting. So we were talking to one of our guests this morning. A guy helps us with the uranium series. I say helps us. He is the uranium series. This guy called Brandon Monroe, very smart guy. And we were talking about some analysis that was done by the Canadian Securities Association on presentations from companies, right? And out of 150 presentations, only 18% actually met the qualification of I've forgotten how they qualified, but it's 18% had no serious or you major miss.
It was in a relevant range of being reasonable.
I
used to do capital audits in my old life.
Right. So it's kind of, I wanted to get the phrase right. It clearly fails. But they're saying, you know, companies overstate the significance of what they've got, especially in their case. They were saying out of the 170 uranium companies currently, only 22 kind of fell within their guidelines of meeting what would be an economic mine, despite what the companies say. So I get what you're saying here. In the world of lithium, you know, miners generally, that people do overpromote and overstate a lot. But sort of coming back to, you know, where you're looking, you love all your children. Great.
Yeah. No, the industry needs all the hard rock that WA can produce. The industry needs all the brine South America can produce. And then you have to look to, you know, take a Standard Lithium who has an interesting project using a bromine stream. And that's in my mind, probably going to be, and I have no financial relationship with Standard Lithium, so all you haters don't need to put anything on my tweets. You see Standard, and it's just a unique situation, and they're partway there. And they're not out overselling it, and their partner, and this is the other point I would make, is if you're investing, you want to see companies with solid partners, because you haven't seen...
So you say, say that again. Okay. I just lost you there.
You have Lanxess. Lanxess is a big German chemical company. That's their bromine operation. And they have a lot of chemical skills to bring to bear. I mean, a junior hiring the kind of people you need on these projects it's not cheap. And there's a dearth of talent. So talent for the lithium industry has to be grown. I mean, people can say, well, that's simple acid-based chemistry, but I think the last 10 years of projects has proven it's not that easy. And so it's the same thing with the Lithium Americas. They got Ganfeng as a partner, and that helps. And as you go forward, I think that's going to be a bit of the model, is that if you're a junior, you better find either a deep-pocketed a battery company that has patience and deep pockets, or a cathode maker. Well, cathode makers tend not to have deep pockets.
Doesn't it come back to the problem I stated earlier, which, you know, we've been seeing, and we've been talking to these companies. It's like, how do you get funded for the next stage of development? So if they haven't got their significant strategic partner, not even saying investment partner, I'm just saying partner who may be able to help them technically or through distribution or in ways other than just pure cash. If I'm a bank, you know, in my days as a banker, I would want to know that the company was technically capable of delivering what they say, because all too many companies, especially with the more, gold, silver, easy, copper, easy, right? But when it's slightly more technical, like a uranium or a lithium, and you've got this, there's a big part of the cost here is process. You've got to have the technical partners on board. And, you know, and I think, you know, we've had some people on here talking about Ganfeng and saying, you know, they've been able to solve problems that others haven't. And they're more investable than if they're in a company, those companies are more investable than others perhaps haven't got those partners in place. I mean, you're pretty much saying the same thing, aren't you?
I'm saying that, but I'm also would nuance it a little more than that. Because if you take, for example, Lithium Americas, they have a team that's done it someplace else at a bigger company. And you don't find, there aren't that many people out there that have experience, but LAC CEO John Evans ran what's now Livent. Rene LeBlanc worked for them for years. And when I used to sell to Tesla supply chain, he was the technical guy who filled in all the gaps that I wasn't capable of filling in on the technology. He went to work for Tesla. And I mean, Tesla's got some alumni out there, because Tesla's not really a happy place to work, from my understanding, given the turnover they have. You don't see many juniors that have, they might have lifetime miners, but it really helps to have lithium experience.
No, I can definitely see that. But right, so I'm an investor. I'm like, where do I look first? We're saying all your children, all of the above are going to be needed, but there's a priority, right? Some are ahead of others. And given that you're saying it's not necessarily hard rock, or it's not necessarily brines, or it's not necessarily clays in any particular order, you've told me you need technical competence or a partner with technical competence. What else should I be looking for?
I think the first fundamental is the asset has to be at least mediocre. I mean, ideally, okay. Ideally you'd want a great asset, but the honest truth is when you look out 5 to 7 years, you're going to have a lot of mediocre assets come into production, or you're not going to have a e-transportation revolution. That's why I say in the end, you can say all you want to about the short-term oversupply, especially of spodumene. That's a noise. Because if you take the big picture, and you look at, have the 3 terawatts for Tesla. 3 terawatts is 8 times 2019 global supply. And he's talking about that for just him. His competitors aren't sleeping. Sometimes it may appear they're sleeping, but I do believe that there will be a significant competition to Tesla before too long. And I know all the Tesla people say, oh, they're too far ahead, but you know, people thought Nokia was too far ahead with cell phones in 2000, and where are they today?
Yeah, nowhere. Yes, gosh, I do remember them fondly. So if I'm looking at the world of lithium at the moment, you said earlier to me, you know, Tesla's not the only game in town. There's going to be all these other use cases, especially in Asia. You know, we've talked on this show variously about the Chinese or Asian ecosystem, the European ecosystem, the US ecosystem, and they're all, and we're getting all critical mineral lists being issued by every country. Can I talk to you about Europe? Okay, because sure. Europe, it seems, it's got some significant automotive manufacturers in there. Not a lot of its own supply, right? There's a few names.
We would have around. To call that supply for this supply chain for lithium zero.
Is zero? Yeah. Okay. Well, that's interesting, right?
At this point, it's binary.
It's kind of binary. Yes, a lot of zeros, not a lot of ones. But it's kind of interesting to me because there are names, there are players, various battery commodity miners, or metal miners, who we've spoken to, and they're making some big claims. You know, we've seen it across the board in Europe. But, you know, whether it be historical mines that can be brought back in production, or countries which claim that they're going to be, you know, major manufacturers. But we're seeing lots of problems, and the problems are because Europe's quite densely populated.
Yes,
we're seeing problems on the ground with the locals. We're seeing permitting and licensing issues. You know, there's a kind of long list of train wrecks on the side of the road.
Not my backyard. I want green energy and I want local supply, but I don't want that mine within 20 miles of my house. And
right.
You're seeing it in projects that they're trying to get approved now. And you're also another real issue. I've based this on conversations with potential investors in a big way in the battery metal space, is that I talked to some Norwegians, not 3 weeks ago, I guess, and their battery plan is 32 gigawatts, and I'm not talking about Northvolt, but they want sustainable. They don't want to have to deal with tailings. I mean, it's like, we want the plant in Norway. We don't want tailings. We want it all to be from solar or whatever. And it's like, I want a pony in my office too, but it's probably not going to happen next week.
What are you saying? He's saying, oh, there's some sort of dystopian Mad Max scenario where people have got to get used to this stuff, and you better get used to it real quick because we're going to run out of it. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not. I'm saying there's enough lithium. If you had a Manhattan project, sorry to use an American analogy on your UK show, but if you had that kind of mindset, then lithium wouldn't be a problem in 5 to 7 years. But you don't have that attitude now. And, you know, I was looking at some big dollar research this morning, you know, one of the top funds, and they're saying EV penetration is 13% in 2025. And I'm saying it can't be. It's too late. If you're talking about a pure electric vehicle and you're talking about, let's just give it a 50 kilowatt hour battery. Well, just do the math. Even if you could use all the garbage lithium that's currently being produced, that wouldn't happen. So people need to get real. And the reason I say I love all my children is because, honestly, people gig me for not supporting their projects. But I say, it doesn't matter what I say, because in this world with this kind of demand, all your crappy projects are going to have to be invested in at some point. But I focus on the best. Because yeah, I'm older and I don't have that much time left.
but neither do investors, right? So, you know, at some point, they're all going to be valuable, right? It is going to be Mad Max in that sense. But right now, investors want to make as quick a return as possible. So we're looking for the best projects. And if I'm looking at Europe, we see a few names, we see a few players. They're all small. There's nothing big in there. And it's a question of, can they ever get into production? Will they be allowed to ever even, you know, will they get the permits to attempt to get into production? Can they get into economic production? And at some point, you know, if the price is high enough, yeah, it'll be economic. But when is important, because I want to make the best investments today. Because like you, I don't have long left. I need to do it now. So are you looking at Europe and saying, hey, that's where I should be putting my money for battery metals? Or are you looking elsewhere?
I find
Europe, that you're a tipster.
I'm advising some people in Europe right now. There's different models. I'm not advising Vulcan, but, you know, Vulcan has the geothermal model. And hey, that that may happen at some point. I'm not somebody saying this can never happen. I believe direct lithium extraction will happen. I take issue with Livent suddenly 20 years later calling what they do direct lithium extraction. But hey, to each his own. The standard lithium, I think, is a big deal because it proves that, okay, we can do this. You don't need ponds. You get it right. But that's a special situation. Every one of these projects is going to require a tweaking and that skill set. We need to see 1 DLE commercial and then it replicated. And then that opens up a lot of brine where there's not the proper evaporation characteristics, which is
right. Okay.
not insignificant. The other point, say Qinghai province, China. I don't know if they have brine in China. It's just garbagey brine. And, you know, I first went there in 2002 and they've probably put almost $2 billion in those projects now. And they produce a very low quality product. And in some cases, they have spent enough money where they're producing a marginal product that can be used in a very low end of LFP batteries. Otherwise, the stuff needs to get cleaned up. Is Europe going to invest in that too? And then let's get into recycling. Europe could be a pioneer in urban mining, and that makes more sense.
Yeah, no, we're talking about the chemical neometals, actually. But I saw you with a neometal shirt on. Are you working with them?
I love Chris, man. I mean,
he's a good guy. He's a great guy.
I have done some work for them. I am not currently involved with them, but I just had him on my podcast. I think it's episode 78. And I think he's one of the best minds in the broader space. Shout out to you, Chris
Reed. Yeah.
And yeah, they make a nice golf shirt too.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. I was wondering.
What swag? I mean,
if you're working with
Crux swag at some point, I'll trade you a Global Lithium hat for a not a mug. Okay. All right.
Right.
We're on.
Okay. We actually do have a merchandise store on our website. You're quite welcome to pick up some items, and I'll send you something. but you know, the neometals, I mean, that whole urban recycling thing, I think it's quite important. People shouldn't forget it. I mean, obviously, you know, we talk about the Teslas, they're going to do it themselves, right? They're going to take control of that.
Is JB going to take control of it for him? Who knows? I mean, he's got Redwood, and you know, there's a lot happening in that space, but a lot needs to. But yeah. I would also say that anybody who thinks that 25 years from now they're not going to need regular lithium mining or chemicals is wrong. Because honestly, if you look at the processes and you listen to the Chris Reed podcast, lithium's the least valuable element there, at least now. And it's the one most likely to just be marginalized or not produced as something you can reuse and then have to be further processed. So it's complicated.
So, okay, because so many things. I do want to talk about, I like Chris Reed, I like neometals, I like what they're doing with their, you know, their project generation.
My second podcast guest, by the way.
Really? Okay. Good guy. But I want to come back to the Europe thing. Okay. So I'm not quite sure how Europe cracks the code, because they're talking about putting, you know, billions of euros up to create their own ecosystem. They're talking about funding companies to allow them to, you know, keep it all in house, as it were. But if they can't get the basics, the fundamentals, the way that they want them, you know, clean, no tailings, no, you know, no this, no that, not in my backyard, all the rest of it. How do they solve that problem? And does that put them at a disadvantage to the, you know, Chinese market, Chinese producers?
Well, I think, first of all, that Europe is really going to have to go interdependent. I think initially for the first 5 or 6 years of a real build out, they'll get some raw material from China, and they'll get some from WA or maybe even Quebec. And that might be the the tipping point to get one of those mines actually operating. But they do want it. They do want to do the conversion. But the interesting thing about when you talk to different people contemplating projects, there's a belief by many in Europe that we need to make carbonate first and make the hydroxide from carbonate because it will be better quality. That also plays into this whole hydroxide. In my mind, last year it was about, in my count, 23%. versus carbonate. And I see it going to almost parity, but I don't, you know, there's some people that said 80% hydroxide in 2025, and that's just fatuous nonsense. It's not going to happen. It can happen, actually.
So, okay, well, some pretty big, I mean, that suggests there's some pretty big fundamental change of logic, change of investing thesis. You know, to be interdependent on other countries outside of your own ecosystem, because the US are trying, they're closing up shop, right? You guys are going America first. We're going to just lock down everything we can do. We're going to look after ourselves, right?
You must watch CNN.
I'm just looking at, I don't actually.
Thank you for that.
I know.
Anyway, let's not go there.
Anyway, let's not get political here. But you know, I do speak to a lot of people every day, and you know, and they're from all around the world, including a lot of Americans. You know, most weeks I'm speaking to several Americans, and they're sort of different views of what's going on. It's very polarizing your politics at the moment, for sure. But when I talk about the business of mining, you know, it's a little bit protectionist at the moment, because you guys are sort of getting a bit nervous about some, you know, access here. We just had the uranium, for instance. You know, you got rid of the Russian suspension agreement, for instance. Okay, you've just put out your critical minerals list, 37 minerals on there.
I agree with you, but this isn't new. If you go back to the Obama administration, if you wanted to have a Chinese company develop a lithium mine in America, that wouldn't have happened under Obama, because the DOD weighs in. And so everybody that thinks if Biden gets elected, it's things are going to change that way, don't hold your breath. This is not a Trump-driven, all the noise about, you know, the China trade war, okay, but with respect to critical materials and especially if they're defense applications are a tiny amount, there's a security of supply concern, and that will be paid attention to. I firmly believe that.
No, I get it. I'm not trying to make it a you know, the Republicans would do this, the Democrats would do that. But I think it's that point at which, you know, technology is evolving, and there's the need for all of these materials, and you want to have security of source, you want security, with significant volume of demand coming down the road to be able to say we're going to be able to meet our own needs here. So we've got things like, you know, Section 232s cropping up for, we've just had it with uranium, we've got it with vanadium. There is a kind of new language being used, not just by the Americans, actually, you know, Europe, but UK, most countries put out a critical minerals list, right? But because of that kind of slight national interest component to this, it's going to get tougher to secure these supplies. And we're starting to see a few countries like the US the US government, right, has just put up some money for a nickel supply in Brazil. The UK government has done the same in the UK in a deal with Rolls-Royce. So you've got governments kind of stepping in here.
In my mind, if you take it back to lithium, I just wave my hand at anything they've done up till now. Until the Department of Energy is authorized to subsidize loans to actually do something to get the ball rolling, you can hardly blame China for being farsighted and saying, hey guys, we need to go around the world and pick up these assets. America can say, well, we want to let the markets work, but you know, the markets don't always work in time, and we need to see some action. But you can say the same thing about the OEMs. Volkswagen had the lithium inquisition a few years ago and it didn't work. And they tout their contract with Ganfeng. Well, everybody's got a contract with Ganfeng, and Ganfeng's only going to have 80,000 tons of hydroxide capacity next year, and they won't give any more than 20% of it to any one company. So start doing the math on that when you see, oh, we're going to have 25 fully electric models in 2020, whatever. It doesn't work. It doesn't work out. I mean, the top four lithium companies had 75% of the market roughly last year. And they have to perform better than they've ever performed to even stay, get supply to the 700,000 ton range. And they won't. I mean, if you look at the abysmal record of expansion of SQM and Albemarle's big deals have been acquisition. They bought into Greenbushes. They couldn't make a reasonable hydroxide product at any scale themselves. So they went to China and bought an asset there. These are the biggest lithium companies. And if they're not performing well, okay.
Well, that's the point. That's my point at the moment. So, yeah. You know, why should, like, I'm an ex-investment banker, right? And I've been looking at this market. One, it's really small. So I don't know if I could be bothered getting out of bed, right? Two, it seems like, you know, if you, with the supply side of things, and understand what you're saying about, you know, battery grade, hydroxide, et cetera, I kind of know where I should be focused, but there's a lot of competition in there, and the guys who can do it, they've got a lot of money. But me coming back to me as an investor, it's confusing. It's really confusing environment, because you said to me at the near the beginning, if you've got a strategic partner, technical partner, that's really good. Thumbs up. But Ganfeng have laid a lot of bets here. They've laid a lot of bets for stuff which they fills today's needs. And they're just kind of checking out. They've got we've talked to a few companies who've got Ganfeng in there. And it's kind of like a Newmont or a Kinross coming in and saying, I'll take an option on year one.
15 million in Bacanora was an option. It wasn't a serious investment. You can kid yourself all you want. And Ganfeng's ambitious. I have presentations they made to me in 2003 and 2005 when I was the grand poobah because I was the guy living in China working for a big three lithium company. Well, we see how things have changed. Now they're the big dog. You've watched their scope of ambition change. They went from, I literally have a very, it wasn't spell checked, a PowerPoint presentation they made. And it says, you know, we want to be long-term a strong regional player in the downstream. They started off making metal and butyl lithium. And I watched that gravitate. And the day I introduced them to Lithium Americas, the first thing I said, the first question you need to ask them is, what's your scope of ambition? And they kind of smiled and, you know, was, we want to be number one, period. So you've watched that change. You don't see that happening with an Albemarle or with a Livent. It's quarterly earnings and couching things to the shareholders and earnings calls. And, you know, they can talk a good game. I mean, you get a consultant and he'll this is what you ought to say. But America needs, some of the American companies need to up their game significantly.
I think so. And okay, the learning there, you know, I mean, thanks for that. The learning there for me, because we say this in, across multiple, you know, verticals, commodities, is that just because a big player stepped in, it's nice because it suggests there's a possibility that they'll hang around and go through the various stages and still be there at the company in 5 years' time. Or they can bug out year after year one or year two or year three. And that company's probably at that point tells you everything you need to know about that company's asset. I suspect that in terms of scale, it may be an okay or small operation, but that's about it. And with Ganfeng, they are just playing these bets. They say $15 million is nothing. It's option money.
They have Black Stairs in Ireland. They've had that for years. They have Marianas in Salta Province, Argentina. They have a broad portfolio, but you know, they got to be as big as Livent is now without owning any assets. They were buying brine from SQM. They were buying spodumene from whoever would sell it to them. And it would take any lithium stream byproduct of butyl lithium processes. That's why they're really good at processing, because they had to deal with crap for well over a decade and make good quality battery grade chemicals out of it. That's how they learned. That's why I've always been a big advocate for Ganfeng, because they came up the hard way, they learned well, and now they have money and ambition.
Okay. Are any lithium producers going to get financed this side of Christmas? Or do you think the market is still just weak, too weak?
I think St. Patrick's Day.
Okay. March it is.
No, I'm actually serious. I think,
why?
Because of the COVID and not being able to go on trips and really look at assets. I'm dealing with multiple people that have the wherewithal and have businesses. I mean, if you look at, and this isn't a client of mine, but take a look at somebody like Johnson Matthey, and they're trying to get out of one business and make a transition. And I'm saying that because I'm trying to be UK sensitive. They're now into battery materials. They're not into lithium, but you're going to see redeployments of capital as people are trying to transition. It's just people keep asking me, well, why doesn't Exxon do it? Or why doesn't Shell do it? Or because the whole lithium industry is not worth enough to move their needle. I mean, I'm a little surprised that they haven't like had a development fund or some kind of a skunk works group in their, one of their chemical subsidiaries that did something. Of course, Exxon had a hand in inventing the lithium ion battery and they didn't capitalize from that either, but we could go back and talk about Xerox too, but we don't need to go there.
Okay. So, I mean, nice romp through just generally, we kind of kept it high level, which is nice, but it'd be great. You know, if you get time to kind of drill down on some of these things, because I think we touched upon some quite interesting pointers there. I think as investors, I know you're not tipster, sorry, and I know you're an advisor to a few companies in there. I'd be kind of interested to kind of work out if we can suss who's going to be a winner and who's not. Yeah, so prioritize who's going to be a winner, because they're all going to be winners according to you. So,
well, no, wait. You have to execute to be a winner. I mean, you have to actually go into production. What I'm saying is that everybody, even if your cash cost is what looks ugly now, you know, you may get to go to the dance, but you still have to execute. I don't have a magic wand that can make dogs into caviar. But I would say that I advise Laxo, full disclosure, but if you look at a junior has two assets, one in Argentina, they can't say it, but Thacker Pass, there's more lithium there that hasn't been looked at. I mean, the best thing for me as an investor in LAC is that Tesla didn't get involved with LAC. I would have hated that. The auto companies, and you know, Tesla isn't a traditional auto company, but they're still an auto company. They're bullies. They've always been bullies on their suppliers. You know, I said this on another podcast recently and they bleeped it, but lithium's not going to be the auto company's bitch. I'm sorry. So we can take another random walk down Matt Street.
Let's do it.
Anytime you want to. I don't know what you expected. Perfect. I appreciate the invitation. It was fun.
It was great fun. No, I've got, you know, big following now, you know, across the board. We've got like 60,000 people that have signed up on various platforms with us to hear comments like that. You know, I think more data is better. How people choose to interpret it is down to them. We would like to sort of help them identify the things that may fall over, or at least at least be aware of things which may fall over, and they can make their choices depending on their risk profile, and their understanding. And I know that's what you were about too. So no, I do appreciate you coming on, Joe.
If you make predictions about this industry or put out predictions, all you know the day after you put them out is they're wrong. You just hope they're close. And I've always said that. And I don't claim any kind of infallibility. The advantage that I have on any of these subjects is I don't have to go read the 10K. I can, and I will, and I do, but I can talk to the actual principals in the organization and people further down. You know, and that's the nice thing. I mean, I've got a lot of people in lithium companies now that follow me on social media that DM me all the time and say, yeah, you were right about that. But, or why don't you ask about this? So, and there aren't a lot of people that have that level of access that aren't currently working for a lithium company and would get fired if they acted on any of the information they have.
Oh, well, keep it coming. Obviously, world exclusives would be appreciated. So just pick up the phone, Joe, and let us know, right?
I get one of those cups and a whole new world may open up.
You got it. You may get a special gold one. We've got a special gold edition for experts.
Wait one second here, buddy.
Okay, we're showing off.
I'm going to reappear.
Are we having a cup off?
Yeah.
What's your say? Global Lithium.
Global Lithium. And then nice. That's from Walking the Camino.
Right. Hey, well, you better give us the, what's the URL for your site?
Globallithium.net. Very complex.
Okay. We'll put it in the description so people can't miss it. Can't get it wrong.
At Global Lithium on Twitter. And, you know, I'm expecting a new follower sometime in the next 48 hours. It's named
somebody. Well, our one viewer, definitely my mom, she will sign up for sure.
Okay. It's good. It was a pleasure.
Okay. Thanks, Joe. Have yourself a great weekend, whatever you're getting up to. And we'll speak again soon.
I want to thank Matt Gordon from Crux Investor for having me on his show. At some point, he will release this episode on his platform. His version will be a little bit longer, and he puts it out in video. I liked the way the conversation went. I think Matt's a really good interviewer, so I decided to release this. We have very little crossover in our audiences, so I don't think I'm stealing any thunder from Matt. He has a bigger audience than I do. And with that, I will leave you with the Japanese proverb, Nana karobi ya oki, fall down 7 times, get up 8, which essentially means never give up.